Good morning. This is Dallas Townsend with the CBS World News Roundup. The war between Iran and Iraq is now in its second week, and Iraq claims to be winning. Baghdad asserts that at some points its troops are as much as 60 miles inside Iran and have seized the air base and radar facility at Dezful. Tehran makes no such claim for its forces, but declares it will fight on until the last aggressor is driven out. Iraq's President Saddam Hussein last night offered to stop the fighting on terms that Iran would find hard to accept. Iran's ambassador in Moscow has made counterproposals, including the resignation of President Hussein and the surrender of his army, terms that Iraq would obviously reject out of hand. We'll hear about the Iraqi conditions from Larry Pintak in Baghdad.
They were terms dictated by a victor, and in his midnight address, Saddam Hussein clearly saw himself in that role. Some of the conditions for the ceasefire had been stated all along. Iraqi jurisdiction over all disputed border territories and complete control of the Shatt al-Arab waterway, the oil route over which this war has largely been fought. The third term has never before been publicly enunciated, but it was not unexpected. The return to Arab hands of the three so-called Arab islands in the Strait of Hormuz. The islands, historically Arab-controlled, were seized by the Shah of Iran when Britain pulled out of the region in 1971. The last condition surprised most observers here. Saddam Hussein demanded what he called full democratic and national rights for the people of Iran. It's believed here that the Iraqi leader means by that autonomy for the Kurdistan and Khuzestan regions of western Iran. Baghdad has been supporting separatist guerrillas in both areas. Iran will undoubtedly find these last two conditions difficult to accept, but the war is moving in Baghdad's favor. Iraqi troops occupy most of the Iranian side of the Shatt al-Arab and have pushed deep into Iran and other regions. And Iraq is now quite clearly in a position to dictate terms. Larry Pintak, CBS News, Baghdad.
The United Nations Security Council, which is in no position to dictate anything, last night urged the two countries to stop fighting. But Richard C. Hartlett reports a sense of futility at UN headquarters.
Members of the Security Council take little comfort from their unanimous, polite call upon Iran and Iraq to, quote, refrain immediately from any further use of force and to settle their dispute peaceably. Said one Western diplomat, we're spitting into the wind. Another declared, this is only the beginning. Many are afraid that the conflict is not really under control and that the Council will have to express itself more forcefully in an effort to contain the war, which poses serious problems. For example, if it were to demand a ceasefire, it would be accused of siding with Iraq, whose troops could simply stay in place. If the Council, however, called for ceasefire and withdrawal of troops, where would it draw the line? The best way out would be mediation, but observers note that President Zia of Pakistan, an Islamic leader and friendly neighbor of Iran, was not able to see Ayatollah Khomeini in his goodwill mission to Tehran. For the moment, it appears that Iran has chosen to isolate itself completely, whereas Iraq's foreign minister arrives in New York today to argue its case to the Security Council. Richard C. Hottle at CBS News, United Nations.
The war has caused the loss of nearly 3 million barrels of oil a day from Iran and Iraq, but the industry publication Petroleum Weekly says that even so, the current world surplus of oil can continue for another 5 months. On the other hand, a House subcommittee is issuing a report today concluding that the United States is not ready to handle a major interruption in its oil supplies. And a subcommittee source says that that is exactly what we may be facing right now in the Persian Gulf. Panel Chairman Toby Moffat says President Carter should try to reach some agreement with other countries on spot market oil prices so that if supplies do become short, the price of oil won't go up, just as the demand for heating oil increases with the advent of winter. President Carter returns to New York this morning for the first time since the Democratic Convention renominated him in August. As we hear from CBS News White House correspondent Lee Thornton, New York is vital to Mr. Carter's reelection prospects.
Since his serious primary loss to Edward Kennedy, President Carter's political fortunes in New York have been on the increase, but not nearly enough for the comfort of the Carter camp. And with the strong possibility of losing California, winning New York's 41 electoral votes is a must. Mr. Carter's problems with Jewish voters remain, as does the John Anderson threat. For today's New York campaign trip, Carter strategists originally favored a full day with several major activities across the city. One suggestion had been a visit to the city's depressed Bedford-Stuyvesant section. But there was fear the news media would compare such a visit to the less-than-successful venture into the South Bronx in 1977, and the idea was scrapped. What Mr. Carter will do is campaign in the Garment District, touring a factory and speaking to the annual convention of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. The president already has the support of that union's leadership, but today's appearance gives him a chance to solidify it while delivering the expected assurances about democratic economic policies. Lee Thornton, CBS News, The White House.
Ronald Reagan leaves Los Angeles tonight for a cross-country swing that will take him back to Washington this weekend. Independent candidate John Anderson has two appearances scheduled in the Capitol today. Six members of a militant neo-Nazi group were under arrest this morning in West Germany in connection with the Oktoberfest bombing in Munich, but five have been freed for lack of evidence. Hal Walker tells us about the crime.
12 people have died so far from the blast, and authorities fear that more of the 213 injured are likely to succumb. Police believe the pipe bomb, containing nearly 2 pounds of explosive, was carried to the scene by a member of the gang led by Karl-Heinz Hoffmann, whose followers regularly practice commando tactics in the Bavarian hills, preparing for a Hitler-like power takeover. Authorities speculate that the bomb exploded prematurely, killing the terrorist instantly along with six bystanders at the crowded main entrance to the Oktoberfest grounds. The others died en route to or in Munich hospitals. The dead terrorist was identified as 21-year-old Gundolf Kurler, whose body was riddled with fragments of the bomb casing. It is not known why the traditional Oktoberfest celebration was chosen as a target of the terrorists. Shortly after the explosion, a woman phoned police to say that the bombing was the work of the same group that destroyed part of Bologna, Italy's railway station last month, killing 82 holiday travelers. Al Walker, CBS News, Bonn.
Violence is on the rise in Zimbabwe. The latest instance, a grenade and automatic weapons attack on a suburban Salisbury hotel that killed two people, wounded 27. Ian Mills has details.
All the victims in the hotel attack were black, a switch from the previous week's violence at Goromonzi near Salisbury, where white farmers came under armed attack from former guerrillas living in the area. Saturday's attack on the hotel was the first of its kind in the capital. A group of unidentified gunmen threw a hand grenade into a bar crowded with blacks and then raked it with automatic rifle fire. The gunmen escaped in what eyewitnesses described as an army truck. Police say they're still probing the raid, but so far no arrests have been made. In a country where guns are plentiful and in all sorts of hands, armed attacks are frequent. The tension has been increased by restlessness among the 35,000 former guerrillas who are soon to be moved into black townships outside Salisbury and the southern city of Bulawayo. The government has decided to move them out of their remote bush camps into better accommodation before the start of the seasonal rains. Ian Mills for CBS News, Salisbury.
A leading Catholic prelate in El Salvador charges that government troops last week massacred dozens of peasants while conducting a sweep of leftist guerrilla strongholds. There's a peculiar situation today in California's 43rd Congressional District, reported from San Diego by Barry Peterson.
It may be the only congressional election where inflation and the economy are not the major issues, for in this election, the Democratic nominee is also a grand dragon of the California Ku Klux Klan. Tom Metzger won the nomination last June, and since then has campaigned not so much as a Klansman, but as a friend of working people.
We're just capturing the working people and the small business people. They're fed up. And they don't care whether I belong to the Klan or what I belong to. They want somebody that's going to go up to Washington and fight for them.
His opponent, four-term incumbent Republican Claire Bergner, calls the election a referendum on the Klan.
I really think that the public will overwhelmingly reject the notion of that white supremacy and violence is the way to make social and economic change.
State and local Democrats have gone so far as to urge a vote for the Republican. Some here worry, could Metzger win? No, say most, and then remember, few believed he would make it this far. Barry Peterson, CBS News, San Diego County.
Police on Long Island this morning arrested more than 140 anti-nuclear demonstrators who blocked entrances to the Shoreham nuclear power plant construction site. The price of gold dropped as much as $13 an ounce today in Europe. It was fixed in London at $687.25 an ounce. The dollar is holding firm against most of the major foreign currencies.